That's 212-209-2950. Become a buddy, become a sustaining member, help support and sustain radio station WBAI. 212-209-2950. It's 9 a.m. on a Thursday morning. Coming up next, Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
And this is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we the people for another world is possible if we work to make it so. And I'm really feeling the message of PETA Taj this morning, Equal Rights and Justice. Later in the program, the NYPD is spying on you and spending billions of our money to do so. Did you know that? But first up, justice delayed is justice denied. Still focusing on knocking down police violence and systemic racism, the case of Ronald Anthony Smith. We'll speak with Jessica Gomez, activist with the Justice Committee, and Julie Floyd, the sister of Ronald Anthony Smith. It's been 7 months since Brooklyn resident Ronald Anthony Smith was mowed down and dragged to his death by an NYPD van under the control of 73rd Precinct officers Orkin Mamadov and Evan Siegel, and his family demands justice be brought in this case. These officers need to be fired. Victim Ronald Anthony Smith's sister, Julie Floyd, said, "They get to go home to their brother. I don't get to go home to mine." Jessica Gomez, Julie Floyd, good morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Julie, as hard as this may be, it's important to let our listeners know to build support for you and your family. Tell us about that terrible day and what happened to your brother, Ronald Anthony Smith.
Well, the officers Mamadov and even Siegel were driving, speeding up the median where it's supposed to be safe for you to stand so you can cross over, and just slammed into my brother. Slammed into him and kept going for another 35 feet and just dropped him like a, you know, like a dead animal. And then they didn't give him any CPR. They had one, you know, one hand had their phone in it, and the other one was occasionally pushing down on his chest. It's horrible.
What I want to ask you is, why do you feel that this was more than a tragic accident? What do you expect from or want from the cops that make you feel that they were minimally irresponsible and worse, that this was indeed a an intentional or deprived indifference to human life crime?
Well, the fact that they offered no CPR, the fact that they didn't put a call out for the bus or an ambulance, for the fact that,
it's fine. Take your time.
You know, for the fact that they tried to label him as a homeless man and get rid of the story really quick. They just wanted to get rid of it really quick, so they just labeled him homeless and just brushed it off. And that is what hurts the most, that you just assume because he's in Brooklyn, maybe in that area, that he must be a homeless man. And so that you think you have the right to be able to get away with that. That's not even how you should treat a homeless person. Never mind somebody who's not homeless. You shouldn't treat anybody like that.
Tell us about your brother. Who was Ronald Anthony Smith?
Anthony was a great brother. We had a bad childhood. He always protected me. Wherever I was going, he was always holding my hand, so he always knew where I was. You know, his mother's still alive. He has sisters. He has brothers. He was always, always giving. He worked in pantries. He worked in soup kitchens, handed out flyers, condoms, you know, stuff like that in the city. Always giving, giving, giving to somebody. For, you know, it's just sad that his life was taken that way.
And I want to ask you, what has been the response from the authorities? Let's start with the Attorney General's office, the AG, and so on, that has been so frustrating and painful, to add insult to injury.
Insult to injury, huh?
Yeah.
The AG's office, they refused to answer any of our questions, even the most basic questions, they would not answer. They wouldn't explain how the process works. They refused to update us on the investigation. And they refused to keep us updated in the future on the investigation.
And what do you think that's about, Julie? Why have they treated you that way? How do you understand
it? The other families before got those same basic answers. I don't know what's going on with me per se, why they refuse to answer any questions. But, you know, these are basic answers that they used to answer. For some reason, I'm getting stonewalled.
And do you think that this is part of a pattern in practice? What does this death of your brother personally, but as a black man, all too many black men, women, brown people that have had their lives lost at the hands of the police, do you think this is systemic? Do you feel that you're being treated, that your brother is being treated differently?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's almost like they do it on purpose sometimes. I mean, I couldn't even begin to imagine why our statistics are so much higher than anybody else's, you know. It's just known that black people, brown people, people of color are always in way more trouble with the cops in some shape or form, killed more by the cops in some shape or form, and still can walk away.
What do you want to happen?
Well, I want them in jail because they committed a crime. And if that was me, I would be in jail right now. But we both know that's going to be a far-reaching thing. So they still need to be fired. because that was reckless. You cannot. What were they? This is what I want to know. What were they doing that you didn't see this van approaching this man? And what were you doing that you didn't see that he was on the hood of your van for another 35 feet? What were they doing? There's two of them. That's four sets of eyes sitting in the front. And nobody saw this man. Something's not right. What were they doing?
I want to bring Jessica Gomez into the discussion, and I thank you, Julie. I know how hard it must be to talk about this and the loss of a loved one in such a brutal and vicious way. And as we said, it's been 7 months, justice delayed, justice denied. Jessica Gomez has been a long-standing member of an incredibly important organization, the Justice Committee, and I want to welcome her as she is getting up at an extremely early hour to speak with us today. But Jessica, I want to know about the involvement of the Justice Committee and how it has worked and worked for decades to aid and abet, in the best sense, the families of people who have lost loved ones who have been stricken down by at the hands of the police. And thank you for joining us.
For sure. Thank you so much, Mimi, for having me. We have been doing this work since about 1985. The Justice Committee was born out of the National Congress of Puerto Rican Rights. And it is an organization that works with families who've lost a loved one to police violence, and also works with victims who have been hurt by police violence and are thankfully still alive today. So that work is something that we've learned from our elders who were born out of the Young Lords movement back in the 70s. And we met Julie and her family about 7 months ago, about less than 2 weeks after Ronald Anthony Smith was killed, because the council member reached out to us. That is a method in which we get notified about something happening, and also the other families. Families end up getting phone calls from families who've lost a loved one or are dealing with a traumatic event with the NYPD. And those families link them up with an organizer at the Justice Committee, especially the executive director. So that's kind of our method. And we just have been a staple within the organizing world around police violence in New York City, along with several of our partner organizations around the city.
Now, I understand that your involvement comes from a recommendation by a local council person. We should say their name, since it's good to have local council people who have that kind of relationship with activist organizations. But your particular involvement, the Justice Committee, that is, in this case of Ronald Anthony Smith, what is so egregious, offensive about the treatment and the behavior of the system, from the New York State Attorney General's office to other entities such as the Civilian Complaint Review Board and so on? Take us through a kind of forensic analysis of what's been happening to the family of Ronald Anthony Smith, and we can't say his name enough. Ronald Anthony Smith, presente.
Thank you so much. Yes, Councilmember Crystal Hudson has been super helpful and supportive with the family and linked us up to Julie and her siblings. And I'll take you through the first step, which is the meeting with the Attorney General. And if folks know or might not know, is that back in about 2015, the families of the Justice Committee we're working with pushing for an executive, an independent prosecutor to be able to look over police killings. In 2015, the organizing went on until June of 2020, when there was significant pressure on the governor to sign for a special prosecutor around police killings. That was one of the bills in front of him. George Floyd, if you remember, had just been murdered in May of 2020, and there was pressure for him to sign a couple bills around police transparency / police accountability on his desk. And he signed in an executive order around having a police, a special prosecutor around police killing. This is armed, unarmed victims and deaths in custody. And it turns out that just our organizing around it has been able to permanently create and push that executive order into a permanent state. And that now sits with Letitia James' office of the state attorney general. And this removes the power away from district attorneys. And the reason why that is extremely important, and we've been fighting this battle for over 20 years, is that the district attorneys have an intrinsic like relationship with the NYPD. They depend on the NYPD for information on the cases that they're trying. They work on with them very closely with evidence, with information they're bringing on for their cases, also for testimonies. So that relationship has a significant conflict of interest to ask them to come in and investigate their partners. And so the special prosecutor, the attorney general, has a part of their office that now looks at these cases. And we've had a really good relationship with them. Coming out of the different cases that we've been working on and have been looked at by the attorney general, the Ronald Anthony Smith case is just the most recent. And maybe with some turnover, maybe not some clear transparency and communication in the office, the treatment of the Smith family was very disappointing, to say the least. I've been with the Justice Committee for about 25 years, and this was very hard to see that our organizing, our political and community organizing, has come to the point when we've built out kind of a much more policy and legislative piece of like our work into connecting with these city and state departments. And now to see that a once partner office that was going to investigate these cases really thoroughly and have a transparent relationship with the families and also give them the respect that they deserve during this really trying and traumatic time, to see that their current AG's office was now going to dismiss the family, was not going to answer questions, was going to show them some very difficult footage of the night that Anthony was killed, and then not be able to answer questions. And that is what we participated in. Unfortunately, obviously, the family is just grieving that yet again, that process, and thinking that they were going to get some answers, and they didn't. And then recently, which we had some press at, which was on Tuesday, and that was meeting with the Civilian Complaint Review Board to request that these officers be investigated and fired. And that was a great meeting to tell you they were transparent, they were helpful in understanding what their process was. And the Justice Committee has been building that relationship as well. And I think that, yet not extremely hopeful in that the Civilian Complaint Review Board will come through with what we need them to right now, but definitely an avenue in which to hold them accountable. And I think that's very important. And as long as that we have a path to hold them accountable, we do have the opportunity to seek our demands. And that is our goal.
Well, I'm of course, remain extraordinarily dubious, to put it mildly, about the, even with the best intentions, the powers of the Civilian Complaint Review Board are enormously limited. So I know that there has been an attorney hired and there is a litigation. But before we get into the nature of that, of course, the question always remains why we should have to go in that direction. And Julie, I want you to talk more about the actuality of your experience, which when we spoke off air, was just, yeah, it was an insult to injury. The pain and frustration that your family feels, the longevity of the process of trying to in any way adjudicate or get a modicum of justice on this case has been outrageous. And then you're treated with a level of disrespect. So tell us about your personal thoughts and the politics of the AG's office and why are they not moving as they should for this egregious crime?
Like I said before, I don't know what they were doing before they hit Anthony. And I think once we find out what they were doing, it will explain a lot more. And I think that's what the NYPD wants to hide. I think they know what they were doing. And so they have to cover it up. I never, ever in my life had to deal with none of this. I was just a regular person going on about my business. This is all new to me, and it's quite disappointing. It's quite disappointing. I wish to watch those people on TV thinking they're getting things done. You're not getting nothing done. They ain't trying to do nothing for us.
What has this meant for your family? How does the loss then of your brother coupled with the callousness or even worse, the overt disrespect and failure to probe in a serious and meaningful way this death of your brother. What the heck has this meant for your family and your community of support? People need to understand that.
Well, we're outraged. Like, you know, like I said, we didn't know anything about this. We didn't have any dealings with the law and stuff like that. So this is, like I said, very disappointing. And we're completely outraged, you know, once you're now in that situation to realize just how bad this government treats you. Just how bad the NYPD is. These are not just horror stories off of TV anymore. Now this horror story has become your life. And all of my family is grieving. We're all outraged. But me and Anthony were the closest. And now Thanksgiving is coming. And there's just going to be an empty chair there. Christmas is coming. An empty chair. That's what they left me with. An empty chair. An empty space in my heart and an empty chair for the holidays for all the things that we're supposed to do. We're not ever going to get to do, but they get to go home and do that. So it's very upsetting.
Where is your family going from here? A lawyer has been hired. How do you see continuing to fight and pursue justice for Ronald Anthony Smith?
Jessica?
You want Jessica to take that one?
Yeah, where are we going from here? I'm just going step by step right now. I'm following whatever they do.
Well, Jessica, that's an awful lot of confidence, and the Justice Committee certainly is worthy of that. So, indeed, how do you proceed from here?
From here, the civil suit will take its course. There was a notice of claim filed about 2 months ago, and we'll follow that along. As everyone knows, that is usually just a rite of passage, but not necessarily where the demands really have a huge challenge in front of them. The challenge is meeting with the AG's office yet again and hopefully getting a better response. And that's what we're pushing for. They've had this experience in where we've had the experience, but they have really come through and being transparent and have had a really good relationship with the family with cases that work with the Justice Committee, such as the Delron Small case and the Shahid Vassell. So we're not coming at this as being the Smith case is the only one or the first one that we're working with the AG's office with. We do have a history of a good of a process in which we do have transparency and communication, and that's what we're looking for. And we met with the CCRB, and so that turned out well for the first meeting, and we will be continuously communicating and having a report back about their investigation. So this is the beginning, but this doesn't mean that we won't have more information moving forward in which we can share, and especially with the request for getting the videotapes of that night available and publicly available to the public. So that's what we're pushing for. The NYPD under Mayor de Blasio would essentially put out those videos pretty quickly. And now under Mayor Adams, this has changed. We have not seen the video put out publicly. It's been 7 months. We're waiting for that. We're looking at and we're asking Deputy Mayor Banks to update and to respond to our request, putting out those videos. They're private videos from surveillance cameras, and there's also a couple of NYPD video cameras that were on site as well.
Now, I can't help but notice that you said that the relationship has changed, such as it was with de Blasio in the Eric Garner case and so many others, but it's changed even more so under, I was almost going to say policeman Eric Adams. I don't know when he takes off that police jacket and acts as mayor, but he's certainly merged the two. Your thoughts about Eric Adams, Mayor Eric Adams, and his treatment and response to victims of police violence. And actually, maybe I'll put that to you first and foremost, Julie.
Yes, I was going to have to take this. Like I said, until this happened, I didn't follow any of these politicians because I don't trust none of them.
Yeah, and I think that really says from the place that the Justice Committee is working with, working at as well. Like, this is really similar. We remember Mayor Adams as a police officer and working with 100 Blacks in law enforcement, and that his work there was not well. I wouldn't say that there's anything there to attribute to police accountability or any type of reforming and holding the NYPD accountable for any of its actions. So there is a history there of this blue wall of silence. And his claim to trying to fight or bring on more policing tactics back into New York City and kind of taking on this like very old approach that was kind of put aside its old tactics, its old science that clearly did not work around fighting crime and fear-mongering. And that is what's happened in the last several of the last year or so that he's been in office. And he hasn't been taken off that badge. He hasn't taken it off. And we think that is the part of why he thinks that his policies are going to work, which have shown that they won't across the country and within New York City. And it hasn't showed. If anything, I think it put us back several years.
And I want to give the final words, which will hardly be the last words, that we will hear from the wonderful and courageous and fierce Julie Floyd as she seeks justice for Ronald Anthony Smith. Julie, what finally do you want us to do to support your family, and what should we know as you continue the quest for justice for Ronald Anthony Smith?
Well, you can just, I don't even know, honestly. Keep us in your thoughts and prayers. And just know that I'm not going to stop fighting. I'm not going to stop fighting for Anthony. You know, I can't. I can't. He would be very angry with me if I did.
Still the sister of Ronald Anthony Smith. And your thoughts about, again, creating a portrait of Ronald Anthony Smith for us to hold dear as well as we continue to follow through with you and follow up on your activities for justice for your brother. Tell us again, who was Ronald Anthony Smith?
He was a loving brother. He was a loving uncle. You know, he had, his friends loved him, and he cared for animals. He was just an all-around nice guy who just caught a bad ending for no reason.
And I want Jessica, just to get a sense of the girth of the work that's done by the Justice Committee, quickly in the minute or two that we have left, tell us about where people should be today, if they can. If they can, Thursday, November 17th, in terms of another case that you're working on, which is the police murder of... Kawaski Trawick. Yes. What's happening today?
Yes, today we will have a press conference in front of One Police Plaza at 1:30. I just want to point out that all these families and their events are all linked with the Justice Committee. They're linked throughout the city and the country. They all have something really tragic in common. Supporting one family is extremely important, and supporting any one of those families in any way is how you get involved and support Ronald Anthony Smith's case and the Trawick case. That is super important. So Thursday today at 1:30 in front of Police Plaza, there will be a press conference to holding the officers that killed him in his home in 2019. That is what we're hoping people can come through and support. And then the rally with the family of Delron Smalls on Monday, November 21st. At 12 p.m. in front of 320 J Street. He was killed in 2016 by Officer Isaacs.
Well, we'll continue to follow up on all of these cases on April 14th, 2019. 32-year-old Kawaski Trawick was locked out of his apartment in an assisted living facility, and within 112 seconds of the police arriving after being called, he was shot to death at the hands of the police while he was cooking in his apartment. Justice, justice for all. I can't thank you enough for your strength and dignity and showing us the way, and we must all support. That is Julie Floyd, sister of Ronald Anthony Smith, and for the decades of important work that Jessica Ramos and the Justice Committee have done to deal with the plague of police violence, of police murder. I can't thank you enough, and you all deserve our support, and we'll continue to follow through on all these cases and the work of the Justice Committee. Thank you so much for sharing the story with us of your brother, Ronald Anthony Smith, Julie Floyd, Jessica Ramos. It's our honor speaking with you.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you
so much, Mimi.
Say a name. Won't you say a name?
Can you talk about?
Shakisha Bonville!
continue to lift up this morning the name of Ronald Anthony Smith and call on the Civilian Complaint Review Board to prosecute and the mayor and commissioner to fire the officers involved in the death at the hands of the police of Ronald Anthony Smith. And now the NYPD is spying on you? And what? They're spending billions of your own tax dollars to do so? Well, that's what the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project STOP, a New York-based privacy group's William Owen, Director of Communication, and the Legal Aid Society's Jerome Greco, Supervising Attorney of the Digital Forensics Unit of the Criminal Defense Practice, are saying. And we welcome you to Equal Rights and Justice.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is entirely our pleasure. And I must a special shout out to Jerome Greco, who is a colleague at the marvelous Legal Aid Society. And I must say, the first thing I'm interested in is really how you begin to unearth the facts behind the NYPD's purchase of nearly $3 billion in secret surveillance equipment previously hidden from the public. And guess what it's used for? Spying on and collecting tens of thousands of camera feeds of us. So get us started on that. And I don't know, William, why don't you get us started? And my dear colleague, Jerome Greco, please, let's find out how this information came to light and its significance.
No problem. Thank you so much, Mimi. So NYPD's contracts really do reveal a staggering number, up to almost $3 billion in secret surveillance equipment that had all been previously hidden from the public through the Special Expenses Program, which began in 2007. The Comptroller's Office then and the Office of Management and Budget and the NYPD crafted what they called a Memorandum of Understanding that permitted NYPD to withhold the contracts. And this, you know, really became a surveillance slush fund that did not require approval by the City Council or other municipal officials. So we've been receiving the contracts since the passage of the POST Act in batches. And the number we are reporting now is $2.5 billion more than previously reported during September last year. I'll kick it over to Jerome, who can provide some more information on the POST Act, the Public Oversight of Surveillance Technology Act, and the legal process whereby we obtained the contracts.
Absolutely. Thank you, Will. So the POST Act stands for the Public Oversight of Surveillance Technology, and that was signed into law by former Mayor de Blasio in July of 2020. And it required the NYPD to report all sorts of transparency-related things, including they would issue policies on each type of their surveillance technology that would open it up to a comment period before issuing final policies. And as somewhat expected, their policies fell far short of what they really should be. But one of the things that came out of this was that this memorandum of understanding that existed between the NYPD, the mayor's office, Department of Investigation, the law department, and the comptroller's office. The comptroller pulled out of that memorandum after the POST Act went into effect, and basically saying that there's really no basis to have this memorandum of understanding because the POST Act requires this information to be made public. At that point, both Legal Aid and STOP did freedom of information requests to the comptroller's office for the contracts and related documents that had been hidden due to this memo of understanding, this special expense budget. And just to put that into context, almost every other contract that any other city agency makes, including other NYPD contracts, are public and available to the public and known, and sometimes even required notice before they happen. And these were completely removed from any public database or any public information intentionally. That was the whole purpose of this memo. And as a result of these Freedom of Information requests, we got these contracts that we've now released that show this almost $3 billion in spending on these surveillance tools. And unfortunately, even the agreement that had existed between the comptroller and the NYPD, even the comptroller doesn't have completely unredacted copies. And so most of the redactions that we have in these copies were actually in the copies that the comptroller's office has. And so the NYPD is still hiding some of this information, which maybe would explain even more how this money is being spent.
You take a deep breath. Well, I mean, how is it that these contracts can continuously remain hidden under this, quote, special expenses program, which to begin with is a controversial, and it's a secrecy agreement that was supposedly terminated in 2020 in response to what you were just talking about, which is the passage of the Public Oversight of Surveillance Technology, the POST Act. I mean, what are we missing that this continues? Or is this just part of a covert process that is endemic to the policing apparatus and government in this city that precludes the oversight and the public disclosure of these important things?
You know, I would say that anybody who does, you know, freedom of information type litigation and work, the NYPD is by far one of the worst agencies in the country in terms of transparency and compliance with New York's freedom of information laws or any freedom of information law. And so it's not surprising, but it doesn't change the problem or the seriousness of the problem. And it's really at this point that these documents, just as every other contract, should be made available to the public. I mean, they should have never been secret to begin with, but now there's even less of a reason. You know, even the comptroller's office has pulled out of this. And, you know, the comptroller's office partially exists to oversee spending by city agencies.
Let me ask you this, also, Will Owen and Jerome Greco. How is it that you understand, or what do we need to know about how this money is being used?
So, unfortunately, we can only know so much about how the money is being used with the redactions. You know, we see the amounts, we see the names of the vendors, but it really remains highly opaque. But we do have a few contracts that really stand out to us among the many egregious surveillance technologies included. So there's one contract that reveals more than $400 million spent in recent years on the NYPD's domain awareness system, which is their surveillance system collecting tens of thousands of camera feeds around the city. And that is a single contract with Vexcel, which is a Microsoft subsidiary. There are also a number of contracts showing billions in purchases for facial recognition software, cell phone tracking tools, predictive policing, vans equipped with X-ray machines to detect weapons. Those are warfare vans and Stingray cell site simulators, among many other technologies. So Stingray cell site simulators.
What is that?
So that is a technology that mimics a cell phone tower and allows NYPD to log log the identifying information of any phone that connects to them. So it really allows the police to track people by their phones.
So we're talking about incredibly broad surveillance. I mean, this is just amazing, and it seems to be unbridled and completely arbitrary and capricious. Or is it worse than that? Is it just total for all members of the populace? Jerome?
So, you know, look, anybody can be and probably has been, if you've ever walked through New York City, been caught up in some form of NYPD surveillance. But we know that, you know, they're targeting communities of color, right? They're targeting LGBTQ plus communities. They're targeting the Muslim communities, right? And that's unfortunately historically accurate and currently accurate. And this amount of money that they're spending on these surveillance tools in order to do that, you know, it doesn't change who they choose to target or why. And on top of it, that money that could be better spent for many of those communities on the resources that either they don't have or are underfunded is instead going to the NYPD to spy on them and to keep track of their every movement.
And how do you uncover that it is specifically being targeted against the LGBTQIA community, against the Muslim community? Is that strictly through Freedom of Information Acts uncovery? I mean, how do you know that extremely prescient information?
So it comes through in many ways. One is the reports from our own clients. And the cases that we see at the Legal Aid Society. Another is that there have been multiple reports and in the past, and not specifically related to these specific tools, but, you know, for example, the NYPD got in trouble for trouble. You know, they don't actually suffer any consequences, but got called out for their spying on the Muslim community after September 11th. And not, you know, this idea that everybody they were spying on were terrorists, although that's what they seem to treat it as. And so there's been multiple public reports. There's been multiple lawsuits. And then we know from our own experiences with our own clients and the information that gets generated against them, much of which we are seeing much more because of discovery reform. A lot of that information was being intentionally hidden from us, and the law didn't require them to turn it over. And now that we're seeing it, we're seeing kind of the true horrors that exist.
And I'm wondering, Will Owen, if you can tell us more about, you mentioned one of the contracts. Can you tell us more about the nature of these companies, what we should know, and I assume a difficult and insidious kind of nature to civil society? What do we know of these corporations?
Absolutely. I think both of the words you used very much describe the companies that are part of these contracts. You know, for example, one is Elbit Systems, which signed a contract with NYPD in 2014, and they offer a wide range of surveillance tools used by U.S. Customs and Border Patrol on the southern border. And they're including cameras and sensors that make up the virtual border wall. So we're seeing these, you know, militarized technologies being used here in New York on citizens, on the public. Other tools, other companies that we could mention, our KeyW Corporation, that's the one that furnished NYPD with cell site stimulators, very much an insidious technology that expands surveillance broadly. And then there's some really strange contracts as well that we're still trying to learn more about. There's one for a company called Eastern Horizon that's listed as a camera systems company being paid $2 million as part of a larger $487 million NYPD contract. Mm. And that is listed to the headquarters are listed to an East Flatbush apartment.
An East Flatbush apartment?
Exactly. An apartment in Flatbush. So we, you know, it's very strange, and we don't know what, for example, that contract really is for because of the redactions and just the continued opaque tactics of the NYPD.
Whoa, a lot more drilling down into that one. You'll have to give me the address. I have to pass by the apartment. But I also want to what's concerning to me is that there is certainly a tremendous amount, and it's not the right-wing community, but the liberal community indeed says, wait a minute. Gee whiz, we have the advent of crime. We have international acts of terror against the populace. We have antisocial behavior on the rise. Why shouldn't we? Why shouldn't we spend whatever we need to be protective? Why shouldn't we have thousands of cameras to shot spotter, to facial recognition? Doesn't that help safeguard a community? Now, of course, I'm being devil's advocate here, but I do want Jerome and I want Will Owen to tell us what is wrong with that whole conceptualization that there's some kind of safety that arises for the public from this incredible amount of surveillance technology that is being used against all members of the public.
Sure. Where to start?
Where to start indeed, Jerome.
Part of it, you know, if surveillance prevented crime, there'd be no crime in New York City because New York City has, as we know, as we're talking about, has an incredible surveillance budget, has incredibly invasive surveillance tools, and that's just New York City Police Department, not including the multiple federal agencies here and state agencies that also have surveillance tools and use them here. And surprise, there's still crime. Because that's not what prevents crime. What prevents crime or limits crime is having the opportunities that they need, right? People need housing. They need school. They need employment opportunities. They need health care, and especially mental health care and substance abuse care. And those things, investing in those things, have shown to lower crime. And this idea that, you know, New York City is falling into this cavern of crime and despair is just not true. It's just a way for them to get more money and to justify budgets or attempt to justify budgets like this. And it's just not true. It's funny because, considering how much they're spending on surveillance, if crime is really going up in the way they're saying, then maybe the solution isn't more surveillance. Maybe there should be another answer there. Because if what they're doing is supposedly not working, then maybe you need to try something else. And it seems like that is never considered, but they'd rather just fearmonger people and convince people that they should be scared for every moment of the day and that the taking away of their rights and their liberties is justified as a result. We're never 100% safe anywhere at any time. But this idea that you're always at risk and that this surveillance is going to prevent that is just false.
And Will Owen, let's tackle that from the political and civil liberties perspective. What's wrong? I mean, you have an organization, STOP. Love the name, STOP, indeed. And that is, talk to us about, and I should say again, STOP is Stop Surveillance Technology Oversight Project. Will Owen, what's wrong with this as well from a, again, a civil liberties perspective or for a democracy, which is in such a fragile state in this country?
Absolutely. So I'll add to what Trim said and say that we could be spending these billions on truly anything else related to city life, whether trash pickup, schools, just anything else aside from this invasive, undemocratic technology. And I think, you know, we are seeing a lot of fear-mongering, especially around the subway. A really important example was over the summer, we condemned Governor Hochul's plan to install 2 surveillance cameras in every subway car. And when she made that announcement, she said, if you think Big Brother is watching you on the subway, you're absolutely right, which reveals just how committed the budgets are toward surveillance technology. And this tech, you know, it's really nothing more than security theater, especially given that subway crime actually went down over the summer. And I think with surveillance, it's important to note that it's really much more about perception than actually keeping us safe. It's about, you know, cameras capturing crime scenes for the evening news. But then not actually doing anything as advertised when it comes to preventing crime. And I think the subway shooting in Brooklyn is a very clear example of surveillance not keeping us safe. And when it comes to issues of democracy, we know just looking at history that surveillance and vigilantism, neighbor-on-neighbor spying, is such a hallmark of authoritarianism. And we're seeing the U.S. take that turn in our own society. For example, we recently condemned the NYPD's announcement that it will join Amazon Ring's Neighbors app, which is a public-private surveillance partnership that promotes vigilantism and racial profiling and neighbor-on-neighbor spying. So seeing this, so beyond just the government handling surveillance in an undemocratic way, we're also seeing surveillance more and more outsourced to the public, which is highly concerning when it comes to democracy.
As we wind up, talk about where you go from here, the future work. Jerome Greco, supervising attorney of the Digital Forensics Unit of the Criminal Defense Practice, not an easy thing to say, but it's a statement in and of itself. Where do you go from here to address this? And William Owen, director of communications of the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project. Stop.
So the first thing, the Legal Aid Society is currently suing the NYPD to get unredacted copies of these contracts, so we actually will know exactly what has been said under those big black marked pages. And the second thing is, I think in the immediate, the city council needs to be holding hearings. The hallmark of democracy and of freedom of information laws is knowing where the money is being spent from these agencies, on what it's being spent on, how legitimate those purposes are, and how successful those expenditures are. And the NYPD seems to think they're immune from that. And unfortunately, many city agencies throughout the years have allowed that to occur. And so I think in the immediate, we need the city council to hold the hearing, and we need stronger both city and state laws preventing the purchases of these type of technologies.
And in the last 30 seconds, William Owen.
Exactly. I will add that we're optimistic that we can pass legislation to confront this invasive, undemocratic technology. STOP is not here to hinder technological innovation, but we are here to introduce legislation that stops the abuse of technology. So echoing all that Jerome said, we do think that we need laws to shield from the misuse of data for policing and all surveillance technology.
And we will keep